the doctors gave me two options, which was either, you know, telling my parents, your son is going to be a vegetable, like his brain is not going to function the way that it should anymore. He'll be a vegetable or he's going to die. And that's it. And they brought the priest in for me. God. And I just woke up.
Shut up.
I just woke up. Know you're worth enough to give yourself a chance.
Welcome to Rise Above. I'm Kevin Lanning, your host, along with my co-host, two-time gold medalist Olympian, two-time lightweight champion of the world, Kayla Harrison. Today, we have a truly inspiring guest with us, John. A New York native, John has journeyed through 10 years of sobriety after battling addiction, facing run-ins with the law, and even surviving a life-changing coma. His story of resilience and transformation is nothing short of remarkable. Now, John uses his experiences to inspire others. Let's rise above with John.
What is this, a school for ants?
John, welcome to Rise Above.
Thank you for having me. I feel so so empowered to be with
you. He's about to tell you to move closer to the mic, just so you know.
Dude, you are already fucking up. Like,
I can just see it on his face. He wants to be like,
yeah. D for effort.
No. Can we
talk about how I wore a bathing suit? I know I'm not doing anything at your sparring session tonight, but I wore a bathing suit.
No, he's prepared. He's prepared for anything.
I know.
I'm going to American Top Team in a bathing suit tonight. I can't wait. I'm going to get ripped.
Let those yams out.
Let them out.
Oh, God.
Bring them out. Bring them out.
All right.
Everyone, he's just, you have to be on best behavior, though, okay? Because sparring is pretty serious.
No, I won't say it. I know.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Your friends are very intimidating.
I just want you to know I'm going to be in like serious Kayla mode later because it's like I only have a couple sparring sessions left and like it's crunch time. And so like I put on the like don't fuck with me face.
No problem.
So it's not personal.
No, I know.
But like don't fuck with me.
Kayla's going to have the blue steel going.
So will there be a camera there?
Yeah.
Well, I what should I say? Should I be like I'm from Dagestan?
Don't do this with your hands.
Nobody knows me yet.
Oh, but they will.
I'm the only blonde Dagestani.
I'm Kamzat's cousin.
I'm very nice.
I love how he just said Kamzat. Okay. So, who are you?
Enough of the shenanigans.
Yeah.
I'm
buckling it up.
Okay. All right. Somebody's
reeling
got
it in.
Today we have John R. from all the way from New York. So, John, your father lived. So, John and I, audience, grew up together. We've known each other since we were, what, six, five, seven?
At least 30 years, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we've known each other for a minute. So, we used to play sports together. We used to play baseball together, basketball together.
Who was better?
John was better at basketball. He had very good ball control.
My jump shot is still off the chain.
Yeah, his ball control was really good. And I would say, yeah, dude, you were better at baseball than I was as well. I mean, I was a catcher. We were different positions,
yeah,
so it's kind of tough.
Yeah.
I didn't want to bring up any, like,
no
rivalry. I'm just teasing.
We're actually in such a good place that, like, we have gotten to a place.
Love to hear that.
No, seriously, like John and I have gotten to a place in our friendship, even fairly recently.
Very recently.
Where we're able to practice humility with one another. Oh. And that creates a safe that's like a
my heart.
I love it.
No,
so, I just love also two men sitting here saying that, you know? Like, dude, that's
we won't say I love you, but no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but you say I love you in many different ways.
Of course.
And I love that you guys are able to practice humility because I think that's tough for the male ego in our society.
We're breaking down societal norms.
Yes.
Breaking down societal norms in a very healthy way. I think it's a beautiful thing what's transpired over the course of the last week.
Yeah.
Right?
Crazy. Yeah.
We'll get into that later.
Yeah, I want to hear about it. But first, I want to hear about you, where you grew up, where you're from, what your family was like. Tell me, give me a little bit of like the early years.
Yeah, I'll give you a little synopsis, a little breakdown. Born and raised on Long Island. My father was a New York City fireman.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, my mom was stay at home for a while. My parents split up when I was 8.
Okay.
Ish. Had a very normal childhood.
Do you have siblings?
I have a younger sister, yeah.
A sister, okay.
Yeah, before the divorce, everything was normal. T-ball, Little League, basketball, like the whole nine yards, right? Yeah. Just quintessential suburbia USA lifestyle. And when my dad left, I noticed things kind of take a change for myself. I was very angry. I was getting in fights at school, in elementary school, once every other week. Like, I was a problem. I was a problem back then. But my family life, as far as immediate family, loving big Italian family, everybody close knit, Sunday dinners at grandma's, like the whole nine yards, it was a beautiful thing. I had a ton of friends growing up. That wasn't ever a problem. I guess until adolescence and early teenage years, I really started noticing, shift, and again, everything was still normal from the outside in.
Yeah.
I was a sports kid, excelled in school. Yeah. I was smart, you know. had a bunch of.
I told you.
Sorry, audience. The guy's not speaking into the mic.
Yeah, no.
Raise it up, dude. Raise it up. Raise the mic up. Rise it. Yep. Turn the thing over a little bit and make it like almost level.
You just want to be like you're almost like making
the back
of
no. This piece right here.
This piece.
No. This piece right here. Just go up. No, turn it more level. You want to go level.
Oh, level.
Perfect. There you go. That's it. Good. Sorry.
Oh, I hear the difference.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
I am so sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, people. It takes
Don't
me a couple
sorry.
Of times.
It's okay.
I'll correct you again. No problem.
Yeah, I know. I'm looking forward to it. I'm prepared.
So you had the quintessential like American upbringing. You come from divorced parents. You have a younger sister. You said you started getting in fights. Did you feel angry? Like, do you remember feeling angry?
Oh, I was pissed off.
Yeah. Do you remember at who or what? Or was it, did you like internalize it?
No. So that's a great question. And something that I figured out along the timeline is that I didn't have the emotional or intellectual capacity at such a young age to even process what happened.
Yep.
Right? My dad was my hero. I used to go to work with him all the time. And my grandfather was a battalion chief in the fire department. My dad, too. And we were both Johns, you know, like the namesake. So I kind of felt like that was my path in life, to follow in the footsteps. And my dad was my hero since I was born. You know, firstborn son, you look up to your father no matter what. And I think the anger of him leaving and having your role model leave the home.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to channel that energy outward. So the human brain just does what it does.
Yep.
And I internalize it and try to make sense of what was going on. And how I did that was I made it mean that there was something wrong with me.
Yep. Oh,
that
God.
I wasn't enough.
He knows. He's
I'm good.
So involved.
I told you he'd be a good guy.
Oh, my God. Well, that's what people, I feel like people don't understand that, right? When you're a child and your caregivers are your first view of a higher power, right? Or of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so when something goes wrong in the family dynamic, and it could, listen, it could be toxic, like it could be a terrible situation, it could be an abusive relation, like it doesn't mean that they shouldn't split up or that something shouldn't happen, but what happens with the child is they don't think there's something wrong with their parents. They need them to be okay in order to survive. So when they leave, they think there's something wrong with them.
Absolutely.
And then they spend the rest of their life like with this wound that they don't even know exists, trying to fix it, make it okay, and they don't even know. Oh God, yeah. So
let me question.
Keep going.
So agreed.
Talk to me. I'm not setting this up. I genuinely don't know the answer to this question. But was it your father leaving, or was it more of just like a mutual? Okay, we're gonna split up and get a divorce, or what was that dynamic like? We could also cut this part out if you don't want to.
Yeah, no.
We can move it on.
My parents weren't one of those couples who fought openly in front of my sister and I. So we never heard them fighting or anything like that, which I think is huge. You know, some parents just, you know, will let it rip
air it
in
out.
Front of whoever. They'll fucking air it out. But there was a lot of energy in the house.
Yeah.
And regardless if there was, you know, verbalized fights and outspoken fights, the energy was there and it was tangible and you could feel that and absorb that too, especially from my mother. She held a lot of resentments against my old man. And, you know, I felt that when he wasn't around.
Yep.
I felt that and I absorbed that. So, again, that's something that wasn't my own. And I took that on from a very early age and didn't have an outlet for that either.
Mm-hmm.
So on top of taking on all of my internalization and what I made it meant about myself, the whole situation, I took on my mother's stuff too.
Yep.
And, you know, being single-digit age, that's a lot to carry for a kid.
Hell yeah, it is. It's too much. We have to do something with it. We have to figure out how to survive and cope and numb and
There's this one thing that I read by an author, Dr. Russell Kennedy, and he wrote a book on anxiety that I just finished reading that was unbelievable. And he dives into the whole childhood dynamic thing in detail. And he says that when you're a kid, regardless of like the toxicity in the home or whatever, you come from a broken home, parents are divorced or whatever, you never stop loving your parents.
Yep.
But what you do is stop loving yourself.
Oh, wow.
And I get goosebumps just
saying that. What is this
just
book called? I'm going to add it to my list.
Anxiety RX.
Anxiety
Shout
RX.
Out to Dr. Russ, dude.
Okay.
I love that.
That's funny. Awesome. The parents are the constant. You are the variable to yourself.
You are the variable to yourself.
Isn't that wild?
That is crazy.
It's amazing.
You're not true to yourself. So, like, when you down the road, I'm not speaking you. I'm just saying
in general,
the human person, down the road, eventually you have this false image of yourself because you're still in that learning phase, you know, at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, you know, and it's I'm glad you said that. That's a...
Yeah, unless you have a modality to process that belief system, you take that with you wherever you go for as long as you're willing to hold on to it.
I feel like in order to process it, though, I guess in adulthood, you first have to, like, because I'm thinking about this. Look, I'm a mom. I'm a single mom. Mm-hmm. I adopted my kids. They come with a lot of trauma. I come with my own fair shit of trauma,
right.
You know, and so, like, trying to give them the modalities to process and heal that wound that I didn't create, but I damn sure don't want to help them carry on into the rest of their, like, into adulthood. And also trying to process my own while parenting so that I don't continue this fucking cycle of like this same wound being in every person in our family. And like, so when did you become aware like of the story in your head? From or I guess like the wound. I don't know, childhood wound, I guess. Well, I don't know what you would call it.
That was very well said, too, by you. And I think that's so important, just to touch on that really quick. I think that's so important to pass down that knowledge and those teachings to the next generation so they don't have to worry about carrying those generational traumas, right? The buck stops with you, and I applaud you.
Trying.
I applaud you for taking the time out to, number one, first heal yourself.
Yeah.
And then recognize that your kids come with their own, quote-unquote, baggage as well that they have to heal through, too. And I think that's paramount in living a healthy life. So kudos to you for that. I mean, that recognition within myself, though, didn't come until somewhat recently, maybe 5 years ago. So it took me, I'm 39 now. So it It took me a good amount of time for me to even sit down and be able to sit with myself and figure my shit out and mm-hmm. really even be willing to take that deep dive.
But that's okay. I mean, I think a lot of our listeners are kind of like on that precipice, right? Where they're maybe not feel, maybe they're sober, maybe they're on a healing journey, or maybe they're wherever they are, but there's a piece that they haven't come to understand yet. And it sounds like you, look, healing is, I never say healed, right? Because we never get there. It's just
it's the
existence. Yeah. Like this is life, is to continue to heal and grow and evolve. And so I love that it was not long ago. Like, I mean, it was, I feel like I'm still, like I said, getting to that point where it's, okay, am I going to scream at my son because I was screamed at as a child? Or am I going to stop and am I going to show him, like, mommy's really frustrated right now. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do mountain breaths, or I'm going to ask for a hug, or I'm going to, like, healing moments,
it's,
you know?
It's so hard to interrupt the default system in real time.
The initial thought,
right?
Yeah.
Reaction, response.
Impulsive thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To take action that you're so used to for so long.
Exactly.
No, you're good.
It is the hardest. As a parent, like, regulating your nervous system when you're, like, trying to regulate a child's nervous system when your nervous system is dysregulated is probably the hardest thing I have to do every day as a parent, where it's like, I'm overstimulated, I'm stressed, I'm, you know, operating from a deficit, and I have to be the guide. You're just like, I don't even know what the fuck I'm doing.
No one
taught me how to do this.
But that's also, too, not even with kids. That is every area of my life.
100%.
Mm-hmm. That's with friendships. That's with family. Oh, yeah. My mom texts me. She goes, hey. Hi. What are you doing? Mom, what do you want? But, like, I got to show love and compassion.
Dude, I do that all the time, too.
But, like, hi.
Mom.
Like, Mom, just cut right to it. Like, Kathy, let's go.
Yeah.
I did the exact
Margie,
same shit
let's
to my
go.
Mom the other day. I was like, we're in the thing, and I'm like, you know, we're getting stuff from American Top Team because my aunt and uncle are here, and she's, like, you know, meandering around, and I'm like, Mom, do you want something or not? I need to go eat. Like, I'm fucking hungry. Oh, God, I know. Sorry, well, Mom.
One thing I want to go back and say, though, like, you, so, not to, spoiler alert, John, you're clean, you know, double digits now. You're coming up, I think, on 10 years or something, and I think it's important.
Hit me with that funk flex.
Yeah, baby!
Drop a bomb. No, but I think it's important to say, and I had this experience, you know, well, I'm sober 6 years, but, like, every year I continue to improve. I didn't just take drugs and alcohol out of my life, and then within a month started, you know, the healing. The healing process didn't really start for me. It was a few years later after I took the symptoms, those bad mm-hmm. symptoms that I was impulsively acting on out of my life. And I say that because of the listener who's newly clean or sober, not
why
newly
am
clean
I not better?
Yeah, why, you know, if when I get sober and let's say I go to meetings, am I going to feel better immediately? I hate to tell you,
they're promising me a life beyond my wildest dreams. When does this happen?
Yeah, so look, it's not going to happen overnight, but when it does happen, it is the most amazing thing in the world. And that feeling that you're chasing for so long is what you're living every day.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think it's just important to say that for the well-being of the listener. Mm. And, but go ahead.
Okay, we've jumped around quite a bit.
Yeah,
but
we have,
that's okay.
We have.
Let's bring it back, though.
So you were
8, 9, 10.
So you were angry, but you had sports. So I just want to ask really quickly for my knowledge, was your dad still involved in your life?
Yeah, so okay. I have to say I was really lucky in that regard. Like, okay. My dad was still the coach of all my
okay.
little league teams and basketball teams and
we
stuff like
that. We
used
to have barbecues.
Yeah, I remember all that. Yeah, all the time.
Yep.
All the time. So yeah, he was around.
Was sports a good outlet for you?
Great outlet.
Yeah.
Great outlet.
And what other outlets did you choose as you got older?
It was mainly sports, but you know,
you had recognition though. That's the thing. You played sports. I remember he had our senior year. We played football together. You remember that full page spread?
Yeah, how can I forget? That was my Al Bundy moment
on Long Island. No, seriously, like that. That is a good void. I'm not saying you were filling a void.
I'm so happy you got that reference too.
Yeah, we saw that news article for quite some time. No, I'm just kidding. But like that is it. Seriously, like whenever my little name was in the paper, I didn't get the full page spread, but you know, that is a high within itself, that recognition. And these are all the symptoms that were filling that void inside. Mm-hmm. So sports is a great one. Sports and recognition, you got recognition. Like that helped.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I wasn't – when I graduated high school, I was 130 pounds soaking wet, right?
Oh,
so although
–
although yeah, God bless me is right. So although I did have the – although I did have the skill set for these things, I never had the size.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, I was best friends with Kev growing up. He had the size as well as the talent, you know? And I felt like every guy in our friend group, right – they had the size, they had the skill, they had the talent, they had the real recognition by college schools, and you could pretty much dictate your future. Wherever you want to go, whatever you want to do, you got the world by the balls. Me, on the other hand, was, you know, if you put on 30 pounds, maybe you got a shot.
Mm.
But we don't really see that happening. So, you know, my high school career is pretty much where the end of the road is for you. And as happy as I was to see all my friends going off and getting scholarships, and Kev got a scholarship, and everybody else going away and doing their thing, I didn't have that. So it kind of fed into like that poor me victim mentality syndrome. That,
feeling
that
less than.
Yeah, feeling less than. I was angry about it. I was angry about that. Because I knew I had hands of gold. I could have went and played ball somewhere, anywhere that I wanted to.
Speed, you were very fast.
Yeah, you had it. I didn't have the size, you know? And, you know, obviously that's not something that I was able to change. But, you know, when I started getting onto, like, varsity sports, I'll never forget being in a locker room one time, and somebody comes up to me and he's like, you know, you ever do Vicodins before? He's like, I take a Vicodin before every practice, two before every game, and I am lights out. And I'm like, no, I think I was maybe 10th grade, 11th grade or something. And I'm like, yeah, what the hell? I'll throw one down the hatch. And I felt like I was Superman.
Oh, my God.
That 5'11", 135-pound frame turned into 6'2", 215 real fucking quick,
you know?
And all of that... all of those insecurities, all of that victimhood, all of the lack that I had in my life as far as belief systems and stuff were concerned, they went away. And yeah, I felt like a million bucks too physically, you know, but it was all of the chaos that I had going inside my body that I wasn't even cognizant of at the time. It was there.
Yeah, subconscious.
But, yeah, in the subconscious, but they went away.
Mm.
And I'm like, ooh, I like this for $3.50.
Mm.
My life could get exponentially better with just swallowing a pill. And that was the beginning of the end.
10th grade.
From 10th grade.
Is that what I was selling them to you for, $3.50?
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, my God.
I'm fucking with you. I'm messing around.
For the
Sorry.
ESs. Yeah, you got me for an extra 50 cents.
No,
you
but... well, I was like, did I sell them? Was I the guy in the locker room? I was like,
I remember a guy.
Sorry. No, my apologies. But, I really like that you talked about that because it's the voice in the head. It's the voice in the head that tells you you're not good enough. It's funny because when you have the bug... Now, John, that is a very valid – I didn't even think about that. And, my heart breaks for you about, with sports. And I know, you're in a great space now.
You've done
phenomenal in life. And it's your story has come full circle. But I didn't know. I didn't even think about. I personally was so wrapped up in self and myself and like, what, you know, does my hair look good for my? It doesn't look like that was my breakdown. And it's like, you know, we all have our shit. We both have the bug, and it's we have that voice inside our head. Mm-hmm. And whether it's alcohol, smoking weed, taking oxys, whatever it may be, to quiet that voice and. It just all the chaos in the head goes away.
Stops. Yeah.
When you stop me from drugs or alcohol when I'm not ready, it's not the drug or the alcohol. It's the insanity that goes on in my head.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm gonna like if someone said to me, "Oh, Kevin, you know, I haven't used in 3 days or 4 days when I was in the grips of my addiction," and then as soon as the phone rang, when it was the guy. I automatically felt high already because I knew he was good.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's insane how that
works. The pre-pickup high, yeah, you automatically feel better.
The detox goes away.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane.
Yeah, the mind is so powerful, right? And there's some kind of Buddhist monk or something like that, something I've read along the way was, you know, the mind. If the mind is powerful enough to make you sick, it's powerful enough to heal you.
Absolutely.
As well. And that's just case in point. Mm-hmm. Case in point with that kind of stuff right there. So, yeah, I agree.
So you go on. We're, you know, playing sports, high school, we graduate. What was life like for you once you graduated high school?
All my friends left and went to college. And I was very blessed with the opportunity to get into a construction union right out of high school.
You're probably better off than half of them then.
Well, you want to know something? Hindsight is always 20/20, right? So maybe I don't have a lick of student debt or anything like that, which I have.
Me neither.
I have a bunch of friends still paying them off now, which, it's been a blessing. But, you know, I started getting into an environment now surrounded by a lot of alcoholism, drug addiction, in the construction trades. It's kind of, I don't want to generalize it at all because there's a lot of great stand-up human beings that I've met throughout the last 20 years, but, you know, it seems as if alcoholism and addiction play a huge part in a lot of people's lives, right?
Wow. I think everybody's traumatized. They just don't know it.
Yeah, and one way or the other. And I think it became so socially acceptable, especially the alcoholism, right? It's just drinking is what you do. You drink every day. You drink at work. You drink after. And it's, you know, everybody was miserable. Everybody was miserable. So I'm going to work. And, you know, I wasn't home every weekend from... We graduated 2003, so 2003 to 2007, because I just didn't want to be wrapped up in that. I wanted to go out and have fun with my friends. Mm-hmm. I wanted to live the college experience. I felt like I had FOMO. Mm-hmm. I had FOMO.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, shit, this sucks. I'm waking up at, you know, the ass crack of dawn every day. I'm going to work with all these old guys and doing the damn thing. And my friends are having fun. They're living life. This is what you're supposed to do.
Mm.
And I felt left out. So when I really started picking up the drug use heavy, and I'll never forget going to visit a couple of my friends one weekend. Somebody brought like a half ounce of blow up there. I've never done cocaine before or anything like that. I was always scared shitless of it, to be honest with you. And you know, after a dozen beers or so and partying all night, it seemed like a good idea. And my whole world flipped upside down. I was in love.
Really?
I was in love. I was on cloud 9 up in Oneonta. And it was unbelievable. It was the single best feeling that I've had in my life to date.
The high?
That high. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I felt amazing.
Yeah, but what about the come down 15 minutes later?
He never came down.
Kayla, we had a half an ounce that lasted.
I don't know. Is that a lot?
It was a lot.
It's a lot of coke.
Sorry,
it's a lot of coke.
You're not coming down.
But I guess to segue, within a year and a half, I was in rehab for the first time. I spent every single dollar that I had. I was chasing that dragon, boy. I still, to this day, I could tell you exactly where I was, who I was with, how I felt that first time that I sniffed coke. Mm. And I chased that heavy, and I never found it again. And I started getting into Xanax really bad just to come down. I was up for days on end and going to work. Yeah, I was 20 years old, 19, 20.
Yeah.
I wasn't even legal age to drink, and I was in rehab for the first time.
What happened?
In rehab, or what happened that got me there?
Well, how'd you end up in rehab? Your choice? Someone else's choice?
No, parents, finally, they had the intervention.
Mama Dukes?
Mom Dukes.
Spoke with dad?
Spoke with dad.
Yeah,
and then
they joined forces.
They joined forces, yeah.
Sent you off.
Pretty much, yeah.
Was that college years, or?
Yeah, I was 19.
Okay.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
I was sleeping through work because I was up all night sniffing coke, and then at 4 o'clock in the morning, I would decide to sniff 3 Xanax just to go to sleep, and obviously not wake up for work. Those kind of you do that a couple of times, your parents know something's wrong.
Yeah,
yeah. So.
Were you living at home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't. Shout out to your parents for stepping in, and that's what they know. Any parent has a 19-year-old. Our society says, well, send them to, if they need desperate help, it's send them to rehab. Mm-hmm. I feel like at 19, that's so young, right? Like,
I don't know many 19-year-olds that probably had the access to, because you're working, right? You're 19, you're working.
It was a blessing and a curse to be able to be making
so
money.
So you
like
had
that.
The means to have an expensive habit. That's a dangerous mix.
Correct. Yeah.
So what happened to rehab?
Needless to say, at 19 years old, I didn't think I belonged in that.
You didn't think you had a problem. You were managing it. Your life was not unmanageable.
It was unmanageable, and I recognized that even back then. But it was one of those things where I'm like, I'm young. Mm-hmm. I let it get away from me.
Yep.
You know, how are you telling me? I'm not even 21 yet. How are you going to tell me that I can't go out drinking? I can't even go out and have a drink for
my 21st birthday?
A legal drink?
I've never had a legal drink.
Yeah, right. Yeah, seriously. And I did what I wanted. I had a little rehab romance going on in there too with somebody. And
really?
Yeah.
Love the old rehab romance.
Yeah. Mm. I was so tuned out and doing my own thing that they wound up giving me the boot after 2.5 weeks.
Oh,
they're
really?
Like, dude, you're sick.
You got kicked out of rehab?
I got kicked out.
You're toxic to this place.
I'm toxic to this place.
You gotta go.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, you gotta go. You gotta go. So this place was in Pennsylvania, middle Pennsylvania somewhere, and they dropped me off at the bus station, gave me enough for a bus ride home.
Did you go home?
Yeah, I went home.
What'd your mom say?
Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're supposed to be in there for 28 days, and after 2.5 weeks, and of course, I'm like, it's their fault, it's everybody's fault except my own, everybody's fault except my own, so.
Yeah.
At 19, though, who's really looking to, practicing humility and vulnerability and taking a first step in the sense that, admitting you're defeated?
Are you kidding?
At that age?
Well, that's what I'm...
Well, no such thing.
No, that's what...
No shot.
Yeah. And, you're not thinking about anybody else. You're not thinking... Yeah, you're just... I mean, I think at 19, 20, in those early years, whether you realize it or not, we're all chasing a dragon.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, one way or the other.
It's not... I mean, I was chasing that high. It just wasn't in a cocaine bag, It's whatever you're... Your choice is, but we're all chasing that dragon. It's not until we, become a little bit more aware, not just of the world, but internally aware, that we're able to stop and say, oh, wait, is this how I want to live?
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes that takes a while.
Yeah.
Sometimes that takes a
while. It does.
So you get out of rehab. You jump right back into life. Pain was not great enough still.
No.
Yet you did not hit a bottom. No. In your eyes, and you are still going and visiting friends at college, or what?
Yeah, of course. I had to finish a ride out with them, you know? Like, they can't be the only ones having fun.
Did you, like, set up guidelines for, like, okay, I'm just going to sniff coke every other weekend, or on the weekends,
you
I'm just
going to
do Xanax?
I stopped doing coke.
Oh, wow.
I stopped doing coke. I was like, all right, you did take it too far with that. So I did scale back in my mind.
You took the coke out of your life.
I took the coke out of my life, but the drinking just was I was drinking 5 nights a week, especially in the summers and stuff like that on Long Island.
Oh,
like,
gosh.
I was drinking 5 nights a week and going to work and doing the damn thing. I had that 20-year-old liver was able to recover a lot faster.
Like just a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, pretty much. I was able to hold it together for a while after that, just doing that. There was no repercussion or anything like that.
Where are you at with opiates at this point?
I wasn't doing them.
Okay.
I wasn't doing
them. The Vicodin from 10th grade, 11th grade, okay, great, mental note, it was awesome, but you never really ran off with it.
No. Okay. And I don't know. I don't even know how they got reintroduced back into my life to begin with.
Purdue Pharma.
Oh, thanks, Purdue. Appreciate
OCs,
you.
Yeah. The real OCs came out.
But oh my God, when they did come back into my life again, it was like a freight train that you just, I just couldn't stop.
Yeah.
I just couldn't stop.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
So we're all in school. So senior year, I have to tell this story. I'm sorry, John. So John comes up one weekend to Albany. And there was probably like six of you guys that came up to visit. It was me, my other buddy Matt, and then a guy, John, that was played football. We were all living in the same house. So we go out downtown Albany. Downtown Albany, sketchy as fuck. Ooh,
that's an understatement.
It is so hood, so sketchy. But then there are like a couple clubs down there and lounges and whatnot. So... Mm-hmm. We all go out one night, and it's a Saturday night. We're out till, I don't know, 3, 4 in the morning. And I made a mental note. At like 2 o'clock, I didn't see John, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to look for him again, like, before we leave here. Like, whatever. He's probably just doing his thing. So it's like 3, 4 o'clock. I can't find him.
Oh, God.
I'm like, fuck. Like, yo, Matt, I don't know where John... Oh, whatever. He'll come back. He'll make his way back. he knows where we live. He's got our address, right? Well, let's go. Let's get out of here. Let's get a cab, you know? I'm like, oh, damn. So I'm trying to call his phone right to voicemail.
Oh, no.
So we go back to my house. It's like 5 o'clock now at this point. And still no answer on his phone. His phone's still off. And we're just like, shit. Like,
do you know what happened? Okay.
We know what happened. We're getting there, Kayla.
Okay, sorry.
He's
I'm
alive.
Getting anxious. He is alive.
Kayla, yeah, good news. He's
I'm
alive.
Sweat too.
He made it. He made it.
He made it. So, whatever. We were like, we got to sleep it off. And like, you need 24 hours before you call in someone missing, especially if they're over 18. Mm-hmm. You have to wait 24 hours. So, we wake up the next morning, and it's like 11 o'clock in the morning. We've been up for like an hour. We're still like worried. Like, where is he? All of a sudden, my phone rings. It's a 518 number, an Albany area code.
Mm-hmm.
It's John. Mm-hmm. He's like, dude, I am in fucking bumblefuck upstate New York. I don't know where I am. I need your address because I don't remember your address. And I need, like, this girl I'm with is going to drive me back. I'm like, this girl you're with is going to drive you back? I'm like, what happened to you? He's like, I met this girl at the club last night and she took me home. But it was like an hour drive to her house. I'm like, what? He was in like Saratoga somewhere. Like,
oh, God.
Unbelievable.
So good for you.
So yeah, this dude, so 45 minutes, an hour later, he comes walking in and he's got a white t-shirt on. It looked like there was blood all over his shirt. It looked like he had murdered someone. We're like, dude, what? You don't want this on?
No, okay, keep going, bro. Keep going.
He doesn't even know it's on his fucking shirt. And we're like, John, look down on your shirt. He was like, oh, my God, it was that time of the month for the girl.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
He
not one of my not one of my brightest spots, Caitlin. Not one of my brightest spots.
Oh my God. So no. It gets a little better. It gets a little better. And I hope to God your mother is listening to this podcast right now.
Yeah, she's gonna listen to it. John, I'm sorry, Mom.
So John leaves. So John leaves. He goes back to Long Island. It's like 7 o'clock at night.
Did you give him a t-shirt?
Yeah, probably. Probably not, actually. What am I saying? The shame ride home in the bloody tea.
Oh, my God.
So, all right. So it's like 7 o'clock at night at this point, Sunday, and I get a phone call from... Now, I know John's mom. I grew up with his family.
Right.
I love her mom to death. And, like, I love... Like, they're very close with her, you know? Mm-hmm. So I can mess with her, too, a little bit. So I get a call from that 518 number. It's the girl. She was like obsessed with John. She's like, hi, did your friend go back to Long Island? Like, I don't have his, you know, he obviously doesn't have his phone. Like, how do I get in touch with him? I'm like, I know exactly how you get in touch with him.
No, you did not.
I said, this is when house phones were still around.
No,
I said, yeah, 631-957. I'm not going to say the rest, yeah, but please. I still remember that number.
Oh,
and
my God.
I was like, just call him. He lived at home. I'm like, do me a favor, if his mother answers, you better introduce yourself. Don't be rude. He calls me like 20 minutes later. He's like, you motherfucker. How fucking dare you?
Oh, my.
She started talking to my fucking mom. Bro, I don't want to see this girl ever again in my life. Like, what the fuck?
Oh, no. You're terrible. Oh, my God.
Sorry, Mom. Kevin apologizes for that.
I do. I love Margie.
You better go make amends. Damn.
You know what?
You know, that is it. Yeah, you should.
That's a good point. I have an amends to make. She's honestly probably so happy that we're all like we should.
That girl's gonna watch this someday and be like, "It was me."
Coming out of the woodwork. Yeah,
she's
gonna
hit you back up though, dude. Oh, you better watch out.
Yeah.
Throw up the bat
you.
Signal. Have you come over to Saratoga again?
Okay, so, dude, if that wasn't rock bottom, tell me about when you hit rock bottom.
Yeah, let's. Yeah, we can.
I don't.
Sorry.
That was a rock bottom. That
no,
was
she was like, that was just
something.
Like a typical Saturday
yeah, that
night.
Was a Saturday night.
Those were the good times. Those were the good old days.
Whenever OxyContin started coming around is when things really got bad, and we had a couple of friends who, you know, were able to forge prescriptions and you know, doctor shopping, the whole nine yards. So having pills was never an issue whatsoever. Having money, that was another story. But to shorten it up a little bit, it went from the Oxys to the Roxy 30s to heroin probably within the course of 5 years, depending on how good or bad my bank account was. You just started going cheaper and cheaper down the line.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting a lot of drugs from Queens at this time through a dude who I knew from the apprenticeship program in the union. Great dude, God bless him. He passed away now, but great dude. And I wound up meeting my future ex-wife at one of his parties, and unbeknownst to her, she didn't know that I had an active drug addiction. I did tell her about my past and all this kind of stuff. And she lived out in Arizona, so we were doing like a long-distance relationship from Long Island to Arizona, which in and of itself
was
pretty taxing. I think 27 or 28, 28-ish.
Okay.
But it worked out awesome for me because I'm like, I could have my cake and eat it too.
Yep.
And all I had to do was like save face for 4 days, 5 days out of a month, and I could go back to doing whatever the hell I'm doing. And it works out good for somebody like me. Toward the end, I was getting more desperate and putting myself in more positions that normally I wouldn't, just for the sake of I need a fix. And even though every cell of my body knew that I was putting myself in sketchy situations, I would do it anyway and just kind of keep my fingers crossed. And that kind of luck ran out after a while. And I started getting arrested like left and right.
Really?
In New York City, too, nonetheless. You know, the amount of overnighters that I've done in Queens Central booking for little white boy like me from the suburbs, that even wasn't enough to, like, scare me straight, you know?
When you started this relationship, like, did you feel, because addiction is just a symptom, right? It's not the actual, like, did you feel yourself maybe wanting to change, or were you just like, no, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing and find a way to manipulate this system so that I can have both? Or did you feel like, did the relationship cause you to feel like, okay, well, now I have someone who loves me and wants to be with me, maybe I can...
Right. No, I...
You know what, I, you know what I'm trying to say?
I totally understand.
Like, codependent. A different kind of addiction, but...
Yeah.
Or were
I
you
did,
just
I
so
did
deep?
Want to change.
You
I did
want to.
And she had a son, too, who I adored, and I think he was, like, 3 or 4 at the time that we started dating and stuff. But I did want to change for them because I had all of my childhood traumas and baggage that I didn't want that kid to go through. And I'm like, okay, well, even though I'm across the country, I could still be a father figure and I could still be a stand-up person with integrity and show this kid how to become a man. But on the other end of the spectrum, when the withdrawals kick in, everything goes out.
Yeah.
The window, you know, everything. Survival.
Goes,
survival mode completely. And when I started getting arrested a lot, she kind of started putting the pieces of the puzzle together. Stevie Wonder could see what the hell was going on behind closed doors. You know, it didn't really take much. But things kind of came to a head. I got locked up like 3 times in the matter of a couple of months, which I'm grateful they didn't throw my ass in Rikers Island for that. But with all those arrests came probation officers, and you got to pee in a cup for this person, pee in a cup for that person, court mandated outpatient rehab, and you got to pee in a cup for them random times.
Drug court.
Mm. So in Johnny's rational addict brain, I'm like, okay, well, this is the schedule of pee tests that I have. I could get high this day, drink detox shakes until I'm, like, blue in the face, piss clean, then I could get high this day. And I did that for a solid 3 or 4 months and was getting away with it. So with every clean piss that I gave them, it just, like, fortified my gusto to keep doing and scamming the system and getting away with it, right? I thought I was playing God.
Yeah.
And, until one day it just didn't work out for me, where I was in a court-mandated outpatient, and I was drinking probably 3 or 4 detox shakes, like those ones from GNC that you would get just to, like, pass a weed test when you were a kid to get a job somewhere. 3 or 4 of those throughout the day, eating nothing, with detox pills from GNC. Like, I was spending $200 a clip every single time that I would walk into GNC just in detox shakes.
Oh, my gosh.
And water. And that's it.
Take it down that day
leading up to
outpatient.
Correct.
Because you potentially could have been drug tested.
Correct.
And if you failed there, then that meant you had trouble with the court.
With the court system.
Okay.
Yeah, correct.
Were you afraid of going to prison?
Oh, yeah.
You were scared.
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah. No, that is definitely not a place where I belong. I'm way too pretty for jail, honey. Come on. Way too pretty. But the those detox shakes, after that meeting that night, it was an all-day fast, pretty much, like a water fast with detox shakes on top of it. And what I've come to learn over the years was that I dehydrated my body to a point where I had a grand mal seizure right when I was walking out the door and just dropped.
Of the outpatient.
If that happened 5 minutes later, I would have been in my car
driving
somewhere, which would have been catastrophic for not only myself, but for whoever poor, innocent people were around me at the time. And I was in a coma for 5 days.
Holy shit.
I woke up in a hospital bed. Obviously, I had no idea how I got there, so I thought I was dreaming at first. So I'm like, oh, just go back to bed, dude. You're having a nightmare, right? And I open up my eyes again, however long later, and I was still in the same spot.
Oh, my God.
And I start looking around, and there was a priest next to my bed with, like, my family. My wife flew in from Arizona at the time, and I'm like, oh, I fucked up this time. Like, this time I fucked up. And, yeah, so what I came to find out was that the doctors gave me two options, which was either, you know, telling my parents, your son is going to be a vegetable. Like, his brain is not going to function the way that it should anymore. He'll be a vegetable or he's going to die. And that's it. And they brought the priest in for me. And I just woke up.
Shut up.
I just woke up. And 2 days later, I walked out of rehab, like, under my own recognizance, like, nothing ever happened. And you want to talk about divine intervention, right? Like, up to that point, I grew up Catholic, and, you know, I didn't go to church any more than I had to or anything. But that was the first time in my life where I really started to believe in a higher power and something greater than myself that brought me out of that situation where, as Kev can attest, like, we went to a lot of funerals in the town that we grew up in for people who were doing the same exact shit that I was, who didn't get spared for one reason or another. And I don't know what that reason is that they didn't and I did. And I almost carried a little bit of guilt around me with that. Like, how come this person died and I didn't? Why me? Like, that survivor's guilt, almost. And, you know, I missed a felony court date because I was laid up in a hospital. They sent my ass right to rehab from there to avoid jail time and a warrant going out for my arrest. And I took rehab seriously. But I knew when I walked out those hospital doors for the last time that was it for me. I got scared straight.
You woke up.
Like, there's no other, you can't dig a bottom out lower than where I was. Like, I'd be 6 feet under. Like, there's no other bottom.
You weren't supposed to live.
No, I wasn't supposed to live. So,
but by the grace of
by the grace of God, I came through. There was a purpose for me in my life, which I didn't know, but whatever, here we are, you know.
I feel like you experience the jails, you experience the, you know, institutions, and then death. That was a near-death experience, and, like, that is the closest that you can come to death, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, even just you having the seizure when you had it, you know, like, that to me just screams God. You
know?
Like, I'm just like, wow, this guy is like, yeah.
I thought about that a lot, too. I'm like, you could have been very easily doing 75 miles an hour on the way home, dude, and just completely ruined, like, countless families' lives when that happened. I didn't, though. Thank God.
Oh, my God.
But, yeah, I went to rehab, got out, and
didn't get kicked out.
I was a model rehab student.
You completed.
I was like Mr. Rehab.
Awesome.
Like the poster boy for fucking
dude,
rehab. It was unbelievable.
You hit a rock bottom.
Yeah. I met a couple of people in there. The place where I went to was like a lot of cops and firemen and stuff like that. They went there too. And I had a guy come who coincidentally worked with my dad at one point and lived in the town that I grew up. And he came
that
up because...
That wasn't a coincidence.
Not a coincidence either. and long story short, I grabbed him after he spoke at rehab. And he's like, take down my number. I have a home group here. There's a lot of great dudes for you, and you have meetings to go to when you get back home, so don't worry. So that was my introduction into AA and the rooms and sobriety, I guess, in and of itself. But when I first stepped foot in a meeting, the wreckage of my past was so illuminating, I guess you could say, where like it felt like within a couple of weeks I just realized how much shit that I put myself through, where my job, I got fired from my job because now I was a liability, obviously. I got fired from my job. I had to deal with all these missed court cases, 3 felonies under my belt, looking at 5 years. I was $100,000 in debt, living at home. I'm 30. I'm getting divorced now. My wife didn't want any part of that either. It was so much at one point that, again, it comes down to, like, that little kid with my dad walking out, not having a clue on how to emotionally process these things. I didn't have the capability or know how to process all of these things either at 30 now. And starting behind the eight ball and having all of this repercussion from my past kind of, okay, here it is on a silver platter, dude. Now you got to deal with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Now you have no choice. You can't numb out. You can't just go get high.
No.
You're making the active choice to sit in it. To sit in the fire and be cleansed, really.
Right, but...
So what, yeah.
I internalized all that shit.
Did you?
Too. I didn't have an outlet for it. No matter how many meetings I went to or how many steps I did or conversations I had with my sponsor or whatever it was so overwhelming that my nervous system got stuck in a state.
Mm-hmm.
PTSD from a near-death experience. Mm-hmm. My anxiety took off. I never had anxiety before. I didn't even know what the fuck it was, to be honest with you. It took off like a bat out of hell. Severe hypochondria. Anything would set me off to the point where I thought that I was dying, like literally dying. And that went on for years. I cleaned my finances up. I mended some relationships. I got back to work. I started doing the thing. I saved up money and all these kind of things. I was a model citizen, right? Mm-hmm. Doing what I was supposed to do.
But still internally,
just in turmoil, complete turmoil.
So yours manifested with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Were you depressed too?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Because I'm like, again, you know, they promised me a life beyond my wildest dreams.
Where is it?
And I feel like I'm handcuffed in a jail cell in my own mind. I put drugs down. I said, when is this going to come to fruition, man? Because I don't feel like I'm living at all. And this sucks. And I don't have anything to numb myself out with.
So really quick, I think it's, and this is why I brought this up before, it's very daunting when you are first getting sober, clean, whatever it may be. It's a tall order. Like, you got to go to meetings every day, but you're looking down the barrel, you know, all these banks that you owe money to, these creditors you owe money to, your credit is upside down, you just got divorced, you got all this bullshit going, and you're living at home.
Right.
Like, that is, I'm getting anxiety just hearing it.
Yeah.
So, okay, yeah, like, overnight, you know, you're in inpatient for 28 days, you go to a meeting on day 29, day 30, you're not going to be healed. Like, it doesn't just make all your problems go away.
No.
What were, from day, let's say you got out of rehab, let's say 29 to 90 or even up to 6 months or even in your first year of sobriety, what did that look like for you, and what were some of the tools that you used that you can maybe pass along to someone listening to help get them that, dude, that first year? I was in debt when I first got sober. Everything was a disaster when I first got sober. What are some of the tools that you used to get through that time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of it has to do with community.
Mm.
A lot of that has to do with community. And one of the pillars of AA is community. And for a long time through active addiction, I alienated everybody who was close to me. I felt like I was just doing this thing alone. This was my problem. Nobody else is coming to save me. And I don't have the trust and belief in myself to even save my goddamn self.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very dark and lonely place to be. And stepping inside the rooms and getting a sponsor kind of reaffirmed to me that there are people who are willing to help you. There are people who are willing to stick out their neck for you because those people have been there and done that
exactly.
before.
Yeah. You hit it right on the head, I think.
Yeah.
I remember going into a meeting and I'm like, I'm 50K in debt. And someone, the next person cheers, like, I'm $1 million in debt. And I'm like, oh, shit. All right, word. I better listen. And I thought my life was so bad. But, like, also that could be a trap door at that rock bottom. Your aunt brought it up. There's always a trap door at the at that rock bottom. If you want to if you're not in that place.
Right.
But to your point, it is great to know that you're not alone and people have been there, and you but you need to lean on those people that have been through it. There's a blueprint for it.
I think that's also a beautiful acknowledgement of, like, that's an act of faith, right? Like, you are in the shit. You're sober, but you're fucking sober and you're in the shit and every day sucks and your anxiety is getting worse and your depression and you're this and you're that. And how are you going to overcome it? And, like, by staying in it and by also finding people and reaching out for help, like, that's an act of faith. That's a choice. Whether you made it willingly or not, like, you chose not to go drink and drug. You chose to slowly, and it doesn't happen overnight. Like, it doesn't happen with the snap of a finger. You don't just, like, wake up and it's fucking sunshine and rainbows.
Right.
But you actively chose every day to do something different than what you did. And that's what faith is. And faith without works is dead. So you made the choice and then you did steps in order to. And it sounds like you did even more. Like, it sounds like you hit rock bottom, got sober, which was like, stop the bleeding, right? Like, stop the bleeding. And then, okay, what's really here? Like, what's really happening?
Yeah, I wish I could pat myself in the on the back for that. But I left the rooms after like a year and a half. And I'm like, I don't want my life to be predicated around a church basement forever. I'm just getting back on my feet. I'm single. I'm young. I got the world by the ball. I don't want my life to be stuck in a church basement on Friday, Saturday nights and stuff like that. I want to go and live my life now. And, you know, I learned a lot. And the one thing that I do regret is that I didn't stick it out long enough to go through all the steps. And 10 years later, I'm going through the steps.
Really?
Now.
Yeah. Really?
And my life has become unbelievable since going through those steps. It's me and my mentor are going through them now, like on a very in-depth, write these things down, your relationships and all this kind of stuff. I wish I stuck it out to do those before, because I think that would have saved myself a lot of suffering down the line that I didn't have to put myself through unnecessarily.
We get there when we get there.
Yeah.
But it made you who you are. It's funny.
Yeah.
I thought, so I was about to like jump in for the listener and be like, well, the church basement does work for some people.
No,
like,
it
don't,
does.
You know, like, I'm still in the basement. Yeah. Like, no. So, but I am so glad that you said that, because you, dude, there are people that get sober, clean, whatever it may be, whatever is their outlet, you know? That don't take a look at themselves ever. They stay abstinent from a substance or a drink or, you know, eating, you know, an eating disorder, whatever it is. And they never look at themselves. You, that's where I think, that's a great tip for the listener. Bury in the step work as soon as you can. Take a look at yourself. As you want the miracle to happen, look at yourself as soon as possible.
Taking that inventory is just paramount. Is paramount for growth and digging yourself up out of the wreckage of your past. That that inventory is why you were an addict in the first place.
Yep.
Doing all these things to numb out the all the bullshit. until you take a hard look at why you were numbing, you'd just be a dry drunk, right? That's what they call them in the rooms, just a dry drunk. What, yeah, you're abstinent, but you haven't really done anything.
What was your catalyst to do that? Because it's really uncomfortable. It's really, really hard to get still and to be with yourself and to look at. It's really, really, really hard. What made you do that? Because you were clean, you were sober, you were living life. Like you said, you didn't want to live in a basement, so you were living.
Yeah.
Take us through the timeline, because I think this is important. You were sharing it with me the other day. The timeline in the fall that kind of like boosted you into this new phase that you've been going through.
Yeah, well, I think the initial, okay, I really need to start to take a hard look at myself was probably 4 years ago, where the suffering of what I knew in everyday moments was unbearable. No, it was so completely unbearable. The anxiety every day really took a toll on my confidence and my self-esteem and how I saw the world. I turned into a negative Nancy in a very large aspect of my life. And I was just perpetuating the cycle of shame, blame, guilt, victim, round and round the merry-go-round it goes.
Oh, yeah.
I wish we could pull up a diagram. because, dude, that is everybody's story.
Yeah.
But we just don't know. You know, like shame, blame, guilt, victim, shame. Yeah.
Yeah.
Over and over.
That you're doing it, but you don't know that you're doing it.
Can't identify it.
No, you can't identify it. And I'm like, I've spent a lot of time in my 20s when I was, you know, clean, not clean, blah, 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 blah. Why am I doing the things that I do? And that was like that aha question that I've relapsed a lot over in my 20s, and I just couldn't figure it out. And when I started getting close, it was too painful to look at. Ugh. So I'd step right back into something that's not good, that'll dull that pain. It was just too much for me to handle. But it got to a point a couple of years ago when I'm like, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. And I'm like, something needs to change. I need to change.
Got to do something different.
And I have to take a good, long step back and analyze what the fuck am I doing in my life that no longer serves me and who the person that I want to become. And you want to talk about a real tough question to answer? It was a lot. My drug addiction ended 10 years ago, but I was still filling those voids. I've slept with over 300 women in my life trying to fill that void.
How many STDs?
I got the clap like 3 times. Oh my. But that's an impressive
ratio.
That's
1%.
That's great. Sign me up for those odds, man. I'll take that.
That's 1%. That's pretty good.
No HIV, no herp, no nothing.
God.
I'm good.
Okay. I'm good. Jesus Christ.
But really.
Dude, that's so important to like, because I did the same shit. We all do it. Like, I don't know if you read that book by Russell Brand, Recovery, where he talks about like.
I have it in my truck.
Yeah. Like, you stop this addiction and then you just like. I recently became acutely aware of how addicted I was to food because I'm in fight camp and because I'm cutting to 135 pounds and because I can no longer use it to like numb, escape from things that make me uncomfortable. I can't order Chinese food whenever I want. I can't like go eat a fucking brownie whenever I want. Like I have to kind of sit in it. And I wasn't even aware. And I consider myself pretty fucking aware, and I wasn't aware that I still do, like, I do that with food. I do that with, like, crazy, like, shit that you don't even think is that bad, you know? And I think it's important. Like, that's really powerful when you say, like, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not a drug addict. But, like, my life could be better, and I want to make it better. So what do I have to do? I have to look at myself and I have to, I mean, I don't know if this is true for you, but I have to become spiritually fit.
Yeah, I didn't even know what spiritually fit.
Yeah, come on, rise above.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
I didn't even know what spiritually fit meant. I didn't even know what spirituality was. I confused spirituality with religion. And I had a, again, I did grow up Catholic or whatever. I wasn't a church guy or whatever, but I just had a problem with the church as an organization that refused to allow me to, like, really believe in God and Jesus. Like, I just had a, I had a thing.
The money.
Yeah. They're corrupt. Like,
well,
I just,
religion is man-made.
Yes, correct.
Faith is a very personal decision.
Yeah.
Religion is something that man created, you know?
Correct.
Like, spirituality is something that lives within you.
Me and you are like, duh. Okay, well, thank you. Like, that makes so much sense. You've just cleared it all up for us.
No.
Well,
but spirit, like, your soul.
No,
your
you're
spirit,
right.
100%.
Your, the essence of who you are and who we all are is something that is not made by man.
Yeah. I needed to get back to that. That version of John who is like happy, joyous, free, childlike again. And that was something that was pointed out to me a year ago from my mentor. He was like, that is really what we're doing is just, you know, as he would put it, we're scraping the barnacles off the bottom of the boat so we could reveal our true selves again. And our true selves are just like that childlike, fun, loving, carefree type of person again. You know, over the course of the years with the traumas and anxieties and worries and bullshit or whatever,
life,
we accumulate those proverbial barnacles. And I didn't even think that I had a soul anymore. I was soulless. That was another reason why I started getting into this. And I was like, there has got to be something more than this. Like, I'd welcome death if this is it.
Do I just wake up every day to go to, like, to live this meaningless life?
Live this meaningless life. You go to work every day. You're up at the crack of dawn. It's Groundhog's Day every day, and nothing is really changing in my life. Yes, I'm accruing some
material
things,
yep.
And, you know, buying the condos and the new trucks.
Did that become a coping mechanism for you, the material things? Did
100%.
Money and power and, like, the new car, the new house, the new girl? I mean, obviously, you don't think I do women.
The new girls.
plural. yeah.
So that was one of the really hard questions I had to ask myself and ask myself on a daily. Like, what brings my soul joy? What does Kayla like to do? You know, what makes me feel most me? And that was a big question I had to ask when I was coming to terms with my career and, like, what I was going to do next. And, like, do I actually like to fight? Does it bring me joy? Do I enjoy this? Or am I doing it because I want people to love me? Because I need to earn love.
What'd you come up with?
She's still fighting.
Both. Both. The answer is both for me. Like, I truly love to fight. Like, I enjoy the process and going to the gym and training. And it's very much a meditation for me, right? Where it's like I'm totally present, because if I'm not, I'm going to get punched in the fucking face. And there's still that little girl inside of me who really wants everyone to love her and accept her and to think that she's worthy. And so it's a little bit of both. But for the most part, you know, I do it because I love it. And I'm wondering, like, what did you find when you scraped off the barnacles? And as you scrape them off, like, what did you find? How do you, I mean, obviously we had to do this at 2 p.m. instead of 1 p.m. because you like to golf, but what else brings you joy?
It took a while for me to figure that out. And I realized that after sitting down and doing a lot of deep peelings away of the layers of the onion which is my soul, that an overwhelming majority of things that I did were just so people could validate me and I could feel accepted.
External validation
was 110% the name of the game for every aspect of my life. And I'm like, well, what does it feel like to do things for me now? What does it feel like to do things for me instead of what society expects from me, what my parents expect from me, what my friends think that I should or should not be doing? I lived for everybody else, and that was a childhood coping mechanism and things that I kind of internalized myself. But it wasn't until really a year ago where I took back, and I again, community is so important, and God works through people. I'm 100% firm believer in that, and I got introduced to these people who gave me a different insight into how life could be lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I would look at these guys, and we all met through stock trading and the stock market or whatever, but these guys were living life in a way that I've never seen anybody live life before. And kind of nomadic, they would bounce around here and there, live wherever, do whatever. And I'm just like, I can't do that. That's not in the cards for me. Until they asked me, well, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And I get goosebumps again, and I'm like, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I be happy and do whatever the fuck that I want to do? This past October, I quit my job. Of 20 years.
Really?
I'm like, this no longer fulfills me. I'm miserable waking up going to work every day. And, you know, over the course of doing this work, you know, the blame game and all this kind of stuff, I've realized that it was all a me thing, that I allowed myself to be treated in search of... funk flex me, funk flex me. That I allowed these things into my life because I felt a certain way about myself. I felt like I didn't deserve respect.
Yep.
So when you
created the story in your head.
I created the story in my head, which manifested itself into real life. And I was living out the stories in my head in real life. And it came to a point where I'm like, you know exactly where this is going to lead you. Right. And all the fears that I've had about the unknown and fear of the failure and all this kind of stuff. What's worse, the fear of taking a chance and not making it,
mm-hmm.
or looking back 40 years from now and being scared of the possibility of what could have been?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And goddamn, that hit me like a ton of bricks. And coupled with, you know, doing some really deep somatic therapy on myself and healing my nervous system, which was crazy. I still do. I just spent the last 2 months with my somatic therapist North Carolina.
That's
and
awesome.
She, God bless you, Judith, you're a saint. She's 83 years old. This woman was like the pioneer of somatic experiencing, worked with Dr. Peter Levine, you know, Vanderdalk, who came out with the book, The Body Keeps the Score.
The Body Keeps the Score.
She's worked with all these people around the world, lived in Hollywood and worked with Hollywood actors and stuff like that for a long time. And I was able to get to the roots of like where the energy was sitting in my body, and I could let those go for the first time in my life. And you want to talk about a weight being lifted off your shoulders? Oh my God, it is a completely new way of living that I didn't even think was possible for me before. And like another thing that I kind of want to get in lieu of that, that I want to get across to the listeners is, you know, no matter the depression and the anxiety and the PTSDs and stuff like that, it's all stuck energy in our bodies. That's why we feel those things. And like depression is all of that chaos in our body that our brain just kind of dissociates with, to the point where its coping mechanism, where it's trying to help you survive,
right,
just shuts the emotions off.
Right.
When you're depressed, you don't feel anything. Me, with anxiety, everything is just so... Everything
hyper-vigilance.
Is hypervigilance, and this is going to kill me, and they're going to kill me, and I'm going to die.
I think it's important for the listeners to know, too, that when you develop these things, right? Like, you developed that... these coping, the disassociation and the hypervigilance, and you developed these as a child, and they served you. They served a purpose in your life, right?
Yeah.
Like, they kept you alive.
Mm-hmm.
And... the difference is now you're an adult and you're in the driver's seat and you get to decide if, does this still serve me? Like, does me disassociating still serve a purpose in my life? Or, even if it's fucking hard, like, even if somebody dies, even if somebody gets sick, even if I lose my job, even if I, whatever catastrophe that happens, because that's life, right? Like, to live is to suffer. Like, shit is going to happen. Mm-hmm. But you're an adult now, and you can choose, like, okay, I'm either going to stay in my body and be present for this and, like, make the choice to not disassociate, or I'm going to keep doing, like, does it still serve a purpose in my life? Mm. And I think that so many people don't, they don't even know they're doing it, first of all, right? Like, we, our level of consciousness has to continue to grow as a society. But once it does grow, then we also have to realize, like, oh, we're adults. Like, we have agency over our lives. We have agency.
I fucking love that out of you.
Well, that's what you're saying. That's what you're saying.
I fucking love it. No, but you verbalize it in such a profound way that I think is so digestible for so many people. And that's exactly what it is, where it comes down to it. That lifestyle and those belief systems and those mm-hmm. patterns become a choice mm-hmm. after a while once you become conscious mm-hmm. of it. When I lived in the unconscious, it was just autopilot. Mm-hmm. This is what I did, and I never thought that I would be able to dig myself up out and do something different, because this is how it's always been.
And it's your lizard brain, dude. Like, you can't control Absolutely. That part of your brain. You can't control your nervous system. It's mm-hmm. literally wired. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not in control of that. It's once you become aware of it and you can say, oh, shit. And, like, again, I think it's important for I'm sure you're not perfect. Like, I'm sure you don't always...
Not by any means, no.
React or respond or, like, are able to always sit with it. Like, dude, sometimes, I mean, I lost my shit on my son the other night, you know? Like, I was like, I said it's bedtime, you know? Like, you don't always do it perfectly, but the small habits, the daily, okay, I only lost my shit 5 times today instead of 10. Like, okay, you know, like, actively, it's a habit. Like, you choosing to work on your nervous system, like, that, you're rewiring it, you know? Like, yeah. And it doesn't happen overnight. It took fucking 30-some years to get that way, you mm-hmm. know? Like, it's not exactly. going to be fixed in a day.
Yeah, I had to give myself a lot of grace and compassion over the course of this journey, and realizing exactly what you just said, that it took me 38, 39 years to put myself in this spot, that it's not going to change overnight.
Yeah.
And healing is a journey. It's a never-ending journey. And I'll always, keep at the forefront of my brain that, you know, there's always going to be something that is going to mirror something within myself that is yet to be healed.
Mm.
Right? So mm-hmm. I've been single for a very long time. I already know that God, when God puts a woman into my life, that is gonna trigger me in ways that I haven't been triggered
healed.
Before.
Yep.
And it's gonna shine a light on all of those things mm-hmm. where I've yet to really even been able to look at.
Yes.
You know, so you know, just life happens and it puts you in situations to look a little deeper and see things from outside the box a little bit. So it's been crazy.
I love
so
it.
Far.
I
yeah,
love
it's been
it.
Crazy.
That's awesome.
It sounds like it's funny. It sounds like you woke up. It sounds like
time,
after
yeah.
all of this time, you woke up.
Big time.
And, you know, just being conscious, aware.
Yeah, awake.
I really like how you talked about the fear, because I lived in self-paralyzing fear for a very long time. And, you know, you were talking about everything that you did was, you know, because of acceptance or like validation or, and like to take it one step further for me in my experience. I mean, of course, everything I did, everything I said was a facade for people to see me in this amazing light. Like, this is one of our biggest problems with social media in our society today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy because like, I was so much in fear of someone finding out who I truly was.
Mm. Preach, brother.
No, yeah, and like the vulnerability. And then you do it once and you're like, well, it's not that bad, you know? And then you do it again and again and again. And then you start to realize, first off, who gives a fuck what anyone has to say, what anyone thinks, because you're making yourself unhappy to look good in front of them. Like, yeah. On paper, logically, just looking at that, that sounds, I mean, and I'm saying it's idiotic because I did it.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, we've all done
we
it.
We all do it. Yeah.
And not just you. I'm not just pointing the finger at you.
No, but no.
Like, of course.
And it's like all of this paralyzing fear. Like, I would do the most fucked up shit because of, like, that fear. Fear makes you do some pretty messed up things.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's amazing that you brought that to the forefront, because not only are you just sitting here saying, oh, I took a look at myself and, you know, all of these things, you really dove into the feelings. And I think it's important for the listener, for the person who's, you know, trying to get their life together or back on track, who has been living in fear, it's important for them to know what those feelings actually are. Mm-hmm. And
Absolutely.
There is a blueprint. And, you know, I want to ask you, what do you do today now, like, to keep yourself, your head above water, keep yourself aware, you know, for example, you know, meditation? I know you're still in touch with your life coach. Mm-hmm. What are some of the tools that you have implemented today?
Yeah. I am a big meditator now. I think that's helped me tremendously in being able to notice my thoughts instead of becoming what those thoughts are.
Mm.
And so many times in anxiety and panic attacks and stuff like that, I let my thoughts consume me to the point of debilitation, you know? So being able to sit quietly with myself,
yeah,
and notice the thought coming in, and as quick as it comes, noticing it leaving.
Mm.
And I don't have to associate with whatever those thoughts are.
Yep.
That's a choice, right?
Yep.
We have a choice in
mm-hmm.
that. I've cultivated a new relationship with God, which I talked to you guys about last week, which has blown the doors off what I thought life was, exponentially. Actually, and it's funny how on a day-to-day basis I could look and see, wow, this is God's handiwork. Wow, look at him do this. Wow, look at him do that. As long as I keep myself in integrity and honor and live my life in such a way, he continues to bless me and puts me in situations where I'm able to acknowledge his work to begin with. But yeah, I still work with a life coach. I still, on a daily basis, peel back the layers of the onion of my soul. And, you know, I'm not perfect. I never will be. And there's always something that I feel like I could get better at.
Mm-hmm.
Still work with the somatics a lot. But I'm just trying to have a little more fun.
Yeah.
For me, my thing, I've taken life so seriously for so long that I didn't even know what living life was. And you alluded to with the social media thing, I would doom scroll through social media and look at all these people living their lives. And one of the quotes that I love so much is, comparison is the thief of joy. And
Amen.
I would look at other people living their lives, and they're making money, and they have their family, and they're doing this, and they're going on trips and all this kind of shit. And I was like, wow. You know, the more you're absorbed in other people's lives, the more I feel like shit about the one that I'm living.
Yep.
And it's like, okay, well, when am I going to start writing my own book? Now, it's time to start living, you know? And I think quitting back in October was the first step. And diving into what my purpose is, what my dharma is in this life.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you if you, because we talked about like living a life of purpose, and I think that that's such an important piece. I mean, it is like the piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why am I here? Mm-hmm. Why did God spare me from that fucking coma? Why did, you know, like, why are you here? And and what is the purpose? And like, where are you in that?
Yeah, I've asked myself that question probably in the tens of thousands of times in the last decade alone. And it wasn't until somewhat recently where this right here, what I'm doing, what you guys are allowing me to bring to the world, that's my purpose. And I think everybody's born with a unique gift from God. It's not anybody else's place to tell you what that gift is. You yourself have to do that digging and find out what that is. And for me, I spent so much time digging and digging, like finding out, why am I here? What am I doing? Where it was right in front of me the whole time. I have a story that's powerful. I have a gift where I'm able to articulate myself in a way that is digestible for a lot of people. And, you know, the more suffering that I continue to go through means that I have more of a reach and more of an impact with who I come in contact with. And over the course of the last couple of years, like, I've really found a lot of resonance in that, because people would just they would feel drawn to me. Like, I would get random DMs from people I haven't spoke to from, like, high school and stuff that I haven't spoke to in 20 years. And, you know, I would put myself out there on social media and be vulnerable and honest and where I'm at. And they would ask me for advice and ask me for help. And it wasn't until somewhat recently where I'm like, you're really good at this. Mm. You could do this. And there's no other feeling that I get from helping another person that I get from anywhere else. Not the money, not the women, not the this and the that. You know, would I turn down $1 million in the bank account? No, absolutely not. But, you know, one of these days I'll get there. But that would be a byproduct of living my life in purpose.
Yeah.
And it's an enlightening experience, to say the least.
It's so funny because I feel like, you know, obviously everyone has different definitions of happiness and success and, like, but what I have found through this and through just meeting people, the people who have that true joy, like that, like, can't be fucking touched, like, unfuckwithable.
Yes, I love that word, yes.
Like, they give it away.
Mm-hmm.
They share it, you know? Like, when you hold on to it too tight, it slips out of your grasp.
You never get to keep it.
Yeah.
You never get to keep
it's
it.
It's everyone that I have come in contact with that actively chooses to be vulnerable and, like, get shit on and get fucked over and get used and get manipulated, but get back out there and do it again and then do it again and then do it again and then do it again. And but also keep that light, you know, like how you said, I'm doing things for me. Like, that's an important balance. But everybody that I know that has what I consider success or happy, really peace, like, that to me is the ultimate, I don't know, peace for me is, like, the thing that I try to attain, right? Am I at peace inside and outside with the world and with myself?
Same.
And all of the people that I know who have that, they take care of themselves and they give it away. Mm. It's really beautiful. I love that you're doing that.
I agree.
That.
Yeah.
Self-esteemable acts as well.
Yeah.
It's a self-esteemable act to help other people and to give away and to give back and do something outside of yourself.
Right. Instead of it being the shame, blame, guilt, you know, victim cycle, then it becomes the, like, oh, I feel good because I do good. And when I do good, I love myself. And when I love myself, I feel good and I do good. And then I love, you know, like, it becomes like
that
healthy cycle, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
There's one thing I do want to bring up, though. Take a step back a little bit that you didn't give yourself credit for. And something that I've noticed. So the audience, you know, John and I grew up together. We were very close friends growing up. And about 2 years ago, John and I had a falling out. And we recently reconnected. John went on his journey. I had my journey. And we met up about a week and a half ago. Last week, I think it was, whatever. And we were, I mean, I owed you an amends, if anything. And John comes to me and he's like, listen, I want to make amends with you and I want to talk to you. You know, let's have lunch. And which was amazing. And we had a great lunch together. And it's funny. We got into some of the thing, like, this change that I saw in you, and I noticed it when we started talking about some of our actions together as friends, you know, going back 2 years ago, and you kept it all on yourself, like, meaning your actions. And to me, it was, all I saw was accountability.
you were taking all of this accountability, and I was blown away by it. And it, listen, man, I love you for it. It was an amazing experience to see that from you. And it enabled me to also take accountability. Mm-hmm. Mm. So not only are, you know, you're helping me as well. Mm. And I think it's important because we were just talking about, you know, the self-pity and the circle. It was so beautiful what you said. I don't even remember it. But but the point is, you have grown up and you are taking accountability. And I think that's a huge step. That's a huge step for me. That's a huge step for you. I think it's a beautiful thing. No. And things were meant to happen a certain way.
Absolutely.
And you and I call it a 2-year hiatus.
Yeah, that's all. Sometimes you need a little break.
Okay? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate the kind words, dude. And you know, accountability is so paramount for me. And, you know, it stops that blame shame cycle mm-hmm. right dead in his tracks. Mm-hmm. And you know, they say in the Bible, judge not because they know not what they do. Mm-hmm. And dealing with all different kind of relationships in my life, from my parents and my dad and you at one point too, it really flipped the script on judging mm-hmm. other people to make myself right, like coming from a place of ego righteousness.
Yep.
Which is why we had the falling out in the first place, because I wanted to bring you along on the journey with me, not only because I wanted to see you improve, but because I wanted to put myself on a pedestal.
Right.
And that's where the disconnect was, and it obviously didn't work out. It all plays out the way that it's supposed to. But where the hell was I going with this?
But I think that, well, I'm going to cut you off anyways. So yeah, I think that is so
no, please do.
No, I think that that's really beautiful to realize, like, when you live your life by a moral code, mm-hmm. and one, when you take accountability, when you refrain from judging others because, you know, you don't, like, the golden rule, and do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. Like, when you live your life by a set of moral principles, number one, like you said, people are drawn to you, and then you can help more people as a result of that. But again, then you, like, you love yourself, you know, like you realize, like, oh, hey, like, I am a good person. I am doing the best I can. I am in route to becoming who I'm meant to be. Like, this is all happening for me, not to me.
Yes.
And like, that's powerful.
So powerful.
That's powerful. And when you live like that, like, it changes people's lives, and it changes how you interact with people. It changes how you do life.
Yeah.
You know? Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm a fan.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that. Whatever's going on internally directly affects how you see the world and how you show up.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I started, like, really changing the paradigm a little bit, where I went from, oh, my God, like, everything in the world is just, we're going to shit, mm-hmm. you know, hell in a handbasket. you know, there's a lot of love in this world. There's so many good people in this world. And I owe that all to just changing the paradigm a little bit.
There's so many, yeah, there's a lot of love. There's so many beautiful, you're one of them.
Oh, I appreciate
that. That's how
that.
You
so
changed
are you?
It. You're
yeah,
one of
I love
them.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, John, the person who just got out of the hospital, coming out of a coma,
mm-hmm.
let's say they overdosed, let's say they dehydrated themselves so much that they went and slipped into a coma. They're feeling helpless right now, hopeless. Rock bottom. Mm. What would be your advice to them?
Know you're worth enough to give yourself a chance. And it's...
Sorry.
Is that a real cry or is that a fake cry? Dude, that was beautifully said.
I appreciate that.
That was really good. Sorry, I'm done.
Have faith in the process.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, like we touched on 100 times during this conversation, it does take time. And especially in the beginning, first year or so, could be shitty. But there is light on the end of the tunnel. Things do get better. You start to get your money back. You start to get your self-respect back. People start to trust you again. And you'll see the ways that God works to make your life better. You got to believe it, though. Like that's you have to have faith. I got a tattoo on the inside of my arm like 12 years ago. Me and my ex-wife got matching tattoos. It says faith on the inside of my arm. The meaning that it has now compared to 12 years ago, I just thought it looked cool. Like, I didn't know what the fuck faith was, you know? I had zero faith in myself, in the world, and others. Zero. None of that. And I was going to either get it removed or get it covered over. And I don't want that going anywhere anytime soon because it has such a profoundly different meaning for me now. And a little faith goes a long way.
One of my favorite prayers, and like it's usually like in the thick of it, but like, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Like, I have faith, but it's not all the time. So like, help me in those moments that I don't.
Yeah.
Maybe I should get a tattoo.
Yeah.
Do you have any tattoos?
No.
Oh. Oh my God. Hey, you don't put a bumper sticker on a Ferrari, bro.
Whoa.
Yes. Okay. He can come back next week.
John, you want a job as an intern?
Yeah, let's
go. We need
dude.
An intern.
Yeah. I'm in.
Dude, that's awesome.
Thank you so much. Yeah, seriously,
no,
for
thank
your courage,
you guys so much.
For your vulnerability, for your wisdom.
Yeah, man.
Amazing.
You have been a power of example to me, to many others. You're on a beautiful journey. Keep it going, man.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. You guys are doing awesome things in the world, and I'd love to be a part of it.